Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Tom Hudson. It's been an emotional week for Venezuelan expatriates living in South Florida. A few days ago, opposition leader Juan Guaido, the man who the United States and over 50 other countries consider the legitimate president of Venezuela, called upon his supporters to rise up against the socialist regime of Nicolas Maduro. Now, this past Tuesday, some of those Venezuelans went to Our Lady of Guadalupe Roman Catholic Church in Doral to pray the rosary for Venezuela's return to democracy. Former Professor Daisy Ledesma was at the church. She said the lesson that Venezuelans should take from Tuesday is that regime change will take time.
It's something that has to go step by step. It's working. There's not as much military with Guaido as we would like, but the military are getting into Guaido's side.
Joining us in the studio is WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
And to be with you, too.
And from NPR in Washington, we've got McClatchy News Washington Bureau reporter Franco Ordonez. Franco, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we'd like to reach out to our listeners to join in the conversation as always. So please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. A reminder, you can always text us at 786-786-7636. Please give your first name, where you're calling from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. Franco, you wrote an article this week titled, long title here, "It Seemed Like Maduro's Ouster from Venezuela Was Imminent. What Went Wrong?" I can't phrase my first question better than that. So what did go wrong?
I mean, there was so much expectations for Tuesday, so much, for lack of a better word, excitement from those who support Guaido and thought this was the moment. Those early pictures of Guaido standing next to Leopoldo López, who you referred to earlier, as well as military troops, surrounding them, really felt like a moment, a real moment, and a moment that not only that Guaido was calling for, but many people in the United States were calling for. It was the time that the people of Venezuela were going to rise up. And there was a lot of belief that that is what it was going to take. For their part, unfortunately, it does not seem to have had as much of an outpouring as they expected. They expected more military support. They expected more people to come through. And the reality, at least at this point, is that Guaido did not get as much of military support as perhaps he had thought. And we've kind of returned to a bit of a stalemate.
And I see Tim Padgett in my studio. He's nodding emphatically. Tim, in addition to your regular Latin America report for WLRN this week, you wrote an opinion piece calling Juan Guaido's efforts, quote, a long-haul mission. And you sort of suggested that the widespread attitude that Guaido failed this week is actually hurting matters. What did you mean?
Well, I was referring to this rather foolish expectation, driven, unfortunately, in large part by the Trump administration, that regime change in Venezuela is somehow going to happen overnight, which has really been the aura hanging over this since Guaido declared himself Venezuela's legitimate president, and rightfully so, back in January. The fact is, as our woman that we listened to earlier, Daisy Ledesma, the Venezuelan woman out in Doral, I think she said it as well as anybody else. Taking down autocracies and dictatorships and authoritarian regimes takes time. It takes step by step, as she said. And when you try to present what Guaido did as an attempt to bring down the regime in one fell heroic swoop, which is essentially, I think, what the Trump administration was expecting, you give it this aura of failure when, in fact, what happened on Tuesday really was that I think Guaido and his supporters were able to put another crack in Maduro's wall. And that's what it takes to bring down dictatorships. Create those cracks in the wall and keep exploiting them. But it takes time.
But for those who are suffering, those cracks cannot come fast enough.
But I agree with that. But the problem is when you do fail at the attempt to bring down the regime in one fell swoop, it sets you back many steps. So it doesn't help your cause. It hurts it. And that hurts, in turn, the people that you're talking about.
Once again, we're reaching out to our listeners. If you'd like to ask Tim or Franco a question on the situation in Venezuela, please call us now. The number to call is 800-743-WLRN. This question is for the both of you. When we look closely at what Juan Guaido and the opposition party is trying to do, he's been accused of overplaying his hand and overestimating the support he would get from Venezuela's military. So what does it take to coordinate and then successfully execute a civic military uprising in Venezuela? Franco, you go first.
Wow. I mean, that's like a really, really tough question. I mean, we don't know what it will take because it hasn't happened yet in many ways. What every expert, current official, former official that I have spoken with have said, like, look, we want a carrot and a stick. We want to put as much entice military leaders to come over to the side of Guaido while also using a stick to put as much pressure on those in the government that if they don't do that, they are going to face serious consequences. You see that in the financial sanctions. You see that in the sectoral sanctions. You see that in the removal of visas, preventing family members of the Maduro government from being able to travel to the United States. But the reality is Maduro has been able to maintain control over the military. And by doing that, he's also been able to maintain control over the physical, the physical government, over Miraflores, the presidential palace, despite the United States and about 50 other countries saying that, you know, he is not the legitimate president and Juan Guaido is, you know, the legitimate president. But the reality is Maduro still has physical control over the country. And at this point, when I talk to NSC officials, former NSC officials, it is looking more and more like Maduro is going to keep that control.
No, Franco is exactly right. It's a double-barreled approach that you have to take to overthrow regimes of this nature. One, as he said, is the carrot, which in this case means negotiating, and it's a very difficult negotiation process with the military, with the high command of the military in Venezuela, to get them to accept conditions for which they would abandon Maduro. And that's really the hardest part here, because I think the other weapon here that Franco was referring to, the sanctions, I think those have a very good chance of working because the money is running out in Venezuela. Its foreign reserves are bleeding away, and it's not getting any real appreciable revenue anymore from its oil industry, which the regime has destroyed. And so I think if they would just focus more on getting really sophisticated negotiations going with the military so that they would accept the fact that, look, this can't go on. This humanitarian crisis in Venezuela can't go on. We've got to get rid of Maduro and we'll turn on him. That's the key.
Franco, in the midst of the renewed violence in Caracas, the United States has been responding with a threat to Cuba's government. And U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton alleged this week that Cuban troops were keeping Maduro in power. What kind of Cuban presence exists in Venezuela?
It's a great question. I mean, certainly from the United States standpoint, they argue that there are thousands of Cuban officials, military, there working in an intelligence capacity, working in a kind of a public control capacity. The United States argues that without Cuban expertise and able to kind of tamp down on opposition as well as keep control of, you know, potential military folks from kind of jumping ship, that the Cubans have been able to maintain, help, you know, prop up Maduro. But the Cubans, even just this week, say that is not true and that there is no one, there are no Cuban troops there. You know, I think, you know, you talk to whether it's the Trump administration or the Obama administration, previous officials, they will tell you that the Cuban presence is there. The question is how much. What is fascinating is how much the Cuban, Cuba has become part of this discussion. It really was not, and Tim could probably, I would hope he would agree with me, that this was not as much of a conversation just a year ago, and especially during the Obama years. Certainly there was the feeling that Cuba was always a presence, but not as much now. Once Bolton came aboard, there was really, as some people say it, the Cubanization of Venezuela policy, really inserting Cuba in, and there was a lot of feeling that Venezuela was actually just the start of a domino effect that was going to first take down Venezuela, then take down Cuba, and then take down Nicaragua. You guys obviously know Bolton was in town just for the midterms elections and gave that really dramatic Troika of Tyranny speech where he outlined that plan.
Right. Franco, I've got calls coming in, and at least one call from our listeners is asking what role the United States is going to play going forward. Before we get to that, before I take that call, Tim, let's get some historical context here about the economic relationship between Venezuela and the United States when it comes to oil.
Right.
Why is Venezuelan crude so important?
Well, actually, it's not as important today as it was, say, a generation ago when Venezuela used to be our number one foreign source of oil imports. That is hardly the case today. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, the Venezuelan oil industry, that its oil revenues are plummeting. Along with the fact that they have completely destroyed the infrastructure of that industry there. So that's one of the reasons that we felt that we could put these sanctions this year on Venezuelan oil imports to the United States, because we don't rely that heavily on Venezuelan oil anymore.
Right. Now we're going to take a call from Chris in Cooper City, who's got a question about the U.S. role in Venezuela going forward. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello. Hey, this is Chris from Cooper City. I'm glad that I'm on. My question to you guys is, I know there's a humanitarian crisis right now in Venezuela. People are starving. But the options the U.S. has on table, from my perspective, is that we shouldn't be meddling in Latin America. Every time we have done that, I know there's been very bad consequences. On the other hand, there are other humanitarian crises around the world, which, or, for example, Yemen, you know, that we don't do anything about and turn a blind eye. So how do you thread this needle is my question.
Okay. Chris, thank you very much for that comment. I do believe the phone line was a little a little rough there, but I do believe what Chris said was the United States should not be involved, should not be meddling, that when we have... it's led to bad things. Tim?
Well, it depends on what he means by meddling. I mean, if you're talking about us helping Venezuela with humanitarian aid, I don't think that's a malignant form of meddling. I think that's what the United States needs to be doing. This is the worst humanitarian crisis in the history of modern South America. And so you've got, you know, millions of people, millions of Venezuelans leaving the country year by year because they can't find enough food, enough medicine. So I think that's where we do need to be meddling. I think what's dangerous is when the Trump administration keeps talking about, quote, all options being on the table, including military intervention in Venezuela to solve this crisis. That's a whole nother dynamic that we really do need to be very, very careful with.
And Franco, before I'm going to take another phone call in a second, but before I do, how have the sanctions the United States imposed on Venezuela in January affected the situation there?
I mean, I think as Tim kind of alluded to earlier on, they are, you know, having an impact. They're certainly making it harder for the Maduro government to operate. You see that as they kind of scramble to find other sources to sell their oil. But also, you know, as Tim kind of said, it's still early for the that these sanctions have been put in place. The oil sanctions were put in place earlier this year, maybe it was the very end of last year, but there was a grace period, kind of a changeover period, and that period is just starting, real. It was only a few weeks ago that the United States stopped taking oil and there were no more barrels of oil coming to the United States. So it could be like a few months until really those sanctions take effect. And of course, you also have the banking sanctions that were implemented a few weeks ago. So it could be, you know, my experts, people tell me, former officials tell me that over the summers, when you really could see the tightening of the belt and having that impact. The question, though, is how much will Russia and how much will China kind of step in? And can they kind of fill in the gaps that the United States has? And it's a very serious one. And that's why you're seeing Pompeo really put the pressure on Russia.
Yeah, and I would add, Franco, not just Russia and China, but also India. India is a big factor right now. Will they step forward and import more of that Venezuelan oil to help them out?
Speaking of the rest of the world, we've got Sean in North Miami, who's got a comment about U.S. attempts of regime change all over the world. Sean, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Sean. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Good morning. My name is Sean. And to the listeners out there and your commentators in studio, my question is this. Historically, America has gone all over the world disagreeing with people that they have actually helped to install. Once they fall out with Washington, Washington thinks that they have the moral authority to regime change all over the world. And what has happened? When America goes into these countries militarily or covertly to have regime changes, what happens? We have sectoral violence, tribal violence, civil wars. Look at Syria. Look at Libya. Look at Iraq. America needs to mind its own business, concentrate on what is important to America, and stop trying to change the world according to America's doctrine. We have no moral right and no moral authority to do that. How could you want to help the very people that you turn around and impose all these stringent sanctions?
Thank you.
The very people you're hurting. It doesn't make sense, really. It doesn't work.
Thank you, Sean. You know, I think what Sean is expressing here is very, very widespread concern, Tim.
Oh, sure. I mean, again, he goes back to that point I was making between the U.S. helping in terms of humanitarian aid and the U.S. considering a military involvement in trying to dislodge this regime in Venezuela. Most experts agree that that would probably have disastrous consequences. Not only would it bring us into a sort of an Iraq-style quagmire, quite possibly, in Venezuela, it would also alienate the rest of the hemisphere, the very hemispheric nations that we need to help rebuild Venezuela, to help negotiate again, you know, this exit for Venezuela. So I think Sean, you know, makes a good point that this is probably an option that we need to stay away from, and that we need to focus on the negotiated solution to this problem.
Now, Tim, before Guaido made that plea to supporters this week, WLRN aired your weekly Latin America report, which was about Venezuelan political refugees living right here in South Florida who are facing another nightmare. Right. They say they're the victims of bogus Interpol red notices issued by Venezuela's socialist regime. Now, Interpol is what? The international police in Europe.
The international police organization based in France. It was formed about a century ago, and most countries in the world are members, including the United States and Venezuela.
And the purpose of Interpol is, suppose you have some sort of career criminal who's bouncing from country to country, Interpol is honor-bound to find that criminal and bring them to justice.
Exactly. It creates international cooperation in global crime fighting.
And legal experts here say that Interpol is aware of these abuses by the Venezuelan government, but they need to be more vigilant. Now, here is Michelle Eslin. She's a Coral Gables defense attorney who watches Interpol closely and publishes online something called the Red Notice Law Journal.
Interpol allows the same level of credibility for every country, and that defies logic. We know that not every country is as responsible with due process rights or utilizes its criminal justice system properly.
So, Tim, according to legal experts like Ms. Eslin, what can be done here on this end to make sure that those bogus red notices are reined in?
Well, I think one of the key things we need to do is better educate U.S. immigration judges and prosecutors here. Let's say, for example, that a police director in Venezuela is involved in a firefight with one of these groups in Venezuela called the Colectivos, who are pro-government paramilitaries, but they've morphed into criminal gangs. And what happens is, let's say in a firefight, a Colectivo member is shot and killed by police. Well, the government's going to go after the police because these Colectivos are important to them maintaining power in the barrios. So the police directors have to then flee to South Florida to avoid these kangaroo court trials they're going to get held up on. And then when they get here, they get these Interpol red notices issued by Venezuela. And so their asylum processes get derailed. And what we need to do, I think, is educate the judges and the prosecutors here about the realities that are going on in countries like Venezuela so they get these Interpol red notices in the proper context.
And it's not just, you know, a black mark on somebody's reputation. These notices are serious, and convey that, you cited the example of a doctor whose life became an absolute nightmare. And tell us what happened with this doctor, this refugee who's living here in South Florida.
He was a doctor who was treating an army captain in Venezuela who got swine flu, and the army captain died. The family of this army captain happened to be a very powerful members of the Socialist Party, the ruling Socialist Party in Venezuela. They were mad at the doctor. They went after him, and they got prosecutors in Venezuela to concoct what looked like pretty bogus charges of trafficking the army captain's organs after he died. So the doctor fled here. It looked like he had a good case for getting a political persecution asylum here. Then all of a sudden came the Interpol red notice from Venezuela. He gets arrested, detained. His asylum is suddenly derailed. And as you said, he's now fighting a nightmare and fighting deportation back to Venezuela.
And it must be awful for Interpol as well, because how do they divine? How do they figure out what's genuine and what's fake?
They have to start integrating that into their work. That's one of the big criticisms against Interpol, is that it does not do enough investigative work into these Interpol red notices. And believe me, it's not just Venezuela. Russia is one of the worst abusers of these Interpol red notices, and Interpol is getting a lot of international criticism that it's having to face right now.
Right now, we're going to take another call from Siobhan in Hollywood. A question.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Siobhan. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good afternoon to all. The United States record in countries that have oil is somewhat dismal and very, very distressing when you look at the Middle East. And with Venezuela having the largest oil reserves in the world, I'd like to know more. So could your guests speak a little bit more? I think they mentioned that India would be a player. What else? It just seems to me that the oil is probably much more important, and it seems to be glossed over, the oil reserves, and I'd like to learn more. Thank you.
Thank you, Siobhan. Franco, could you answer that question from Siobhan?
I'll do my best. I mean, oil, there's no question that oil is certainly a factor. I would like to note, though, that while they have the world's largest oils, from every expert that I've spoken with, that the oil system, PDVSA, the state-run oil company, has been pretty depleted, and the system is so poorly running now that it would take billions of investment to get it back to that level. But there is no question at all that that is an important factor. I mean, take Russia, for example. Russia is now in the country. The United States is very concerned about that. You can understand. I was talking with some former NSC officials just this week about if they could transfer power from Maduro to Guaido, you would have a friendly power back in control. And as Tim was saying, you can go back to having really a strong use of that oil. I mean, there is that question.
Okay.
I would like to, though,
okay,
to note that.
Okay. Tim and Franco, we need to go, but let's return to the continuing unrest in Venezuela. If in the long run an uprising by Juan Guaido and the opposition party fails and Maduro remains in power, bottom line it for us, What's at stake for the United States? Very quickly, Tim.
Well, this humanitarian crisis just keeps getting worse, and we're dealing with millions of refugees suddenly flooding countries in South America and also trying to get into the United States. Plus, this would fortify a very brutal, authoritarian, and incompetent socialist regime, and that kind of thing metastasizes.
Franco, what's at stake?
So much is at stake. We have the United States have put so much credibility on this issue of toppling Maduro, which was supposed to, as I said earlier, a domino effect to then take down the Nicaraguan leader and the Cuban leader. The United States really wants this foreign policy win, in many ways needs this foreign policy win. To lose that it would be a dramatic pushback on the advancements that they have taken, because up to now it has been a very much a bipartisan issue.
We've been talking with McClatchy News Washington Bureau reporter Franco Ordonez and Tim Padgett, WLRN Latin America correspondent. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Still
Thank
to
you.
Come, Florida lawmakers are pushing for a state takeover of Miami-Dade's Expressway Authority. The county's mayor has been pushing back. That discussion is coming up right after this break. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. The Florida legislature just passed a bill that would dissolve Miami-Dade County's toll roads agency. That would be the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority, MDX for short. Now, this bill would replace the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority with a new board, and that board would take over MDX's five expressways. And current MDX board members would not be able to join the new board. Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez worked to pass toll cuts during her time in the Florida House. On WPLG this week, she said the bill was a long time coming.
I think what you see here is the culmination of a many years level of frustration with MDX being tone deaf, arrogant, and ignorant to the plight of individuals traversing their expressway authorities.
We'd like to reach out to our listeners during this segment, as always. We know wherever there is traffic in roadways, we know people have got a lot to say in this car-heavy South Florida we live in. So please call us, 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. And just a reminder that you can always send us a text. That number to text is 786-786-7636. Please give us your first name, where you're from in South Florida, okay? Joining us in the studio are reporter Doug Hanks, who's been covering the story for the Miami Herald. Doug, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, who is also the chairman of MDX. Thank you so much for this time, Mayor Jimenez.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Doug, this came in right before showtime, the news that the bill passed in the Florida legislature. So which lawmaker sponsored that bill? What was their reasoning?
Well, it was Brian Avila in the House and Manny Diaz Jr. in the Senate, and it launched as a big effort for toll relief, and tolls were actually going to go away in 20 years once the MDX existing debt was paid off, and that quickly went away. Then there was going to be a toll freeze. There are all these sort of discounts and rebates that as it got tougher to get the bill passed, they backed off all that. And so now there's a lot of goals for a toll discount and a toll rebate, toll freeze, but nothing written in stone.
Okay. Once again, if you've been dealing with tolls, and we all do, on South Florida's highways and expressways, we would like to hear from you during this segment. Please call us at 1-800-743-9576. Now, Mayor Jimenez, you've been strongly against this proposal. Briefly tell us your position. Why do you think the proposed toll cuts are a big issue here?
Well, because I think the only one who's really been tone deaf here is the state of Florida. The state of Florida actually charges 60% of all the tolls that are charged here in Miami-Dade County. They're on state of Florida roads, not MDX roads. And the state of Florida continues to raise tolls every single year. Either they do it on a yearly basis or They will wait up to 5 years and then roll in the cost of living adjustment for those previous 5 years into a toll increase. The only entities that have actually raised tolls here since 2014 have been State of Florida Roads. And so for the lieutenant governor to say that the MDX has been tone deaf, I think she needs to actually take off her earmuffs because the people are screaming a lot about the state of Florida and their roads. The problem is the state of Florida has been really good at putting all the blame on MDX, because most people think that all the expressways are MDX. They're not. Mm-hmm. The Turnpike is a state of Florida. The I-95 is a state of Florida. And then now the 826, the Palmetto, which has never had any tolls in it at all, are about to open express lanes on the Palmetto. They're about to open express lanes on the Turnpike. So there's going to be a toll inside a toll. And those tolls are going to increase every single year by state law, by the cost of living adjustment. Now, when I took over as the chair of MDX in July of last year, so I've been basically less than a year as a chair, within 5 days, the tolls on the MDX system went down 5%. So we actually complied with part of what the state wanted, which was a 5% reduction on MDX. We did not comply with the other part, which was they wanted us to implement a cost of living adjustment. That means that within 2 years, that 5% savings would have been wiped out. And so now what have they done? Now what they've done is our credit has gone down. The credit agencies have said that a successor agency is actually, their credit is even going to go down even further, which means borrowing costs have now increased by at least $40 million, probably to $200 million more for the work program that we have on MDX. They have no guarantees of any rate reduction at all. They have actually allowed the new agency to implement a cost of living adjustment. That means increases to the tolls after 10 years, and they allow the new agency to increase tolls by supermajority in 5 years, except MDX had no plans to increase tolls in the foreseeable future, in the next 15 to 20 years. So we've actually gone backwards. We've actually cost the toll payers of Miami-Dade more with the actions they just took today.
So, Mayor Jimenez, no question that the finances, where this ties into road improvements, highway improvements, the financing is very, very complicated to the average consumer,
absolutely,
the average commuter. Well, I'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. Okay, first, a little history. Both of you, Doug, you can correct me if I'm wrong, too. In about 1994, 1995, it was decided that Miami-Dade County was becoming what we call a toll donor county.
That's correct.
And that it was sending all the toll revenues to Tallahassee with not really much in return, okay, for improvement of highways. Am I correct so far?
That's correct.
Okay, and hence the creation of MDX, the Expressway Authority.
Right.
So once again, how many highways in Miami-Dade?
Five.
All right, which are the Dolphin?
Right. Then you have the Dolphin, the Shula mm-hmm. extension, you know, the one that goes to US-1, the 112, the Airport Expressway, and the Gratney. That's MDX. Everything else is not MDX.
Okay. We've been hearing from a lot of our listeners, some South Florida people we've reached out to through our listener network. And here are some responses. Here's Victor in Westchester. He says he pays $800 a year in tolls. Quote, I don't take the expressways. Therefore, I have to wake up earlier and leave later from work.
How does he pay $800 in tolls then?
Michael in Pembroke Pines commutes to downtown Miami. Average monthly expense for tolls is roughly $300 a month. Mm-hmm. That's a car payment. He says, ridiculous. I take more routes that don't require me to drive on toll roads. Subsequently, I leave earlier to work, stay later to avoid major congestion on secondary roadways, which degrades my quality of life with my daughter. So, Mayor Jimenez, can you understand the frustration of these people?
I agree 100%. The problem with this bill, it doesn't do anything about that. Now, I had a plan, a different plan, to actually combine MDX with the Turnpike. And I would guarantee a 20% reduction in tolls. And I would also guarantee no toll increases, no cost of living adjustments for the next 30 years. That proposal would actually save the toll payers in Miami-Dade County $8.5 billion over the next 30-odd years. We would also be able to reduce the tolls on truckers by 50%. We would also, again, not implement the cost of living adjustments that are by law now in the state of Florida. Nothing has been done about that. And also, we would end up with about $2 billion for transportation-related projects here in Miami-Dade County. This new bill does nothing of the sort and does nothing about the state of Florida roads. They're going to continue to increase our tolls. And so, yeah, I understand what he's talking about. I take those toll roads, too. This bill does nothing to alleviate him.
Let's talk about perhaps what it might do. Doug, Let's go back to that rebate program you spoke about a couple of minutes ago. Under the bill, what does it do? What kind of rebate? What's coming back to these commuters who say they're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year?
Well, I mean, I think the honest answer is we don't know. I mean, MDX has a rebate program right now, and at one point it dropped it when it was kind of forced to reduce tolls by 5% from a previous state law that passed that they're kind of suing to block. But it seems that both sides are very focused on the big victim could be what the mayor calls the Kendall Parkway, which is the 836 extension. It's been called a billion-dollar project. Some surplus tolls from that exist now would go to help get the thing going. And so the mayor's financial group has said is with the higher borrowing costs, and if some of these toll rebates, which the bill calls for up to 25% rebate for local drivers, if that could go into effect, you're not going to have the revenue needed to build this huge, historic, and controversial expressway extension.
Right now, we're going to take a phone call from one of our listeners. This is Barbara calling from Fort Lauderdale. She's got a question for Mayor Jimenez. Mm-hmm. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Before I give my question, I actually have a comment. The rebate program, one of what was just being spoken of, rebate gets to be too complicated. If I do this, I get this rebate. If I do the other, it's not worth it. Keep it simple, please. We don't need to pay out to get back. We just need to pay back less. And then my other comment is I keep on hearing on previous programs over the past month or so the mayor talking about I think he said 20% toll reduction.
Yes, ma'am.
That would amount to about billions of dollars.
Yes.
You know, that's fine and good. It sounds good. But when you get down to the little person like myself, that does nothing to put a dent when you're paying so much, when you have to go through 4 to 10 tolls a day going and coming just to get to where you're going. Every little bit chips out of what we have to deal with.
Could I ask you a question? Where do you go? You say you live in Fort Lauderdale. Where exactly do you go? And how do you get there? How do you get there?
I work down in Kendall.
Okay.
And I have to take the turnpike coming across.
That's the state of Florida.
Way,
okay.
And I'm going straight down all the way down to Kendall Turnpike.
Well, Pam, I hate to tell you this, but you're not getting any toll relief because if you're taking the turnpike, you're done. That's not MDX. It's not MDX, so you're not getting any toll relief at all from this particular bill. On the other hand, with my proposal, you would have gotten a 20% reduction in your tolls. But here's the other part too:
we would not have
raised your tolls for the next 30 years. Okay.
Sir.
Yeah. Hello.
Okay. Yeah, I think Barbara's phone line is coming in a little wishy-washy, but let me just sum up what Barbara's concern is, mm-hmm. Mayor Jimenez, is, you know, the overall toll reduction, how does that help? You've already said, that's state of Florida.
Right.
But for somebody else who does travel MDX regularly,
right.
You know, once again, please go through, in layman's terms, please,
sure.
How that helps these people. And we've gotten several calls. We've gotten at least a half a dozen mm-hmm. phone calls from people and text messages from people saying this is in the hundreds of dollars a year, not just a couple of dozen,
hundreds. No, we know that. We know that. But look, the genesis of the entire toll system is the fact that the gas taxes are going down. And so these roads used to be funded by gas taxes, and these are going to go down. 90% of all the roads today, capacity roads are built today in the state of Florida, are toll roads. Why? Because there's not sufficient money from the gas tax in order to build them. So let's put that aside, okay? So if you want the infrastructure, there is going to be tolls. Now, what people are looking for, their toll relief. Yeah, well, if you're paying $100 and you get a 20% reduction, that's not going to pay $100 anymore. You're going to pay $80, all right? And so that's 20%. Under my plan, that would have been 20% reduction on all the tolls. So that would have meant $80, okay? If you travel the Turnpike and MDX, you would have gotten a 20% reduction in your tolls. Under this bill just passed, you're guaranteed nothing. Everything's aspirational. There is no. They say up to 25% rebate, but you don't know if you can get to 25% rebate because you have to do an analysis of the work plan. And if the work, and if you can't do the work plan, then you can't give the rebate. But we already did that on MDX. We know exactly how much we had to toll in order to get the work plan done. So they're not going to be able to squeeze out 25%. And if they do, then they do put the Kendall Parkway in jeopardy. Then they do put other projects, even safety projects, in jeopardy. And so this is all a bunch of smoke. And they say needed reform. What have you reformed? You changed the name of an agency. You changed the name, or actually the governing board, maybe, all right? And you haven't guaranteed 1 cent of reduction, but you've already cost us at least $40 million in borrowing costs. So thank you very much, the state. We appreciate it.
If you've got a question or comment for Mayor Carlos Jimenez or for Doug Hanks, please call us. The number to call is 1-800-743-WLRN. And I think it's a safe bet that virtually every driver in South Florida has had to take a toll road at one time or another.
Me too.
So, and we, like I said, we've reached out via text message to a number of our South Florida commuters, and Juan L. in Miami-Dade says he spends $400 a year on tolls. He says now he's too restricted to drive much of anywhere else. This quote from Juan: a simple trip to the beach is too expensive. Ronald from Miami says all this money that he spends, $500 plus a year, he says it makes him want to consciously avoid tolled roads. So, I'm just curious, Doug. Today is the last day of Florida's regular legislative session. Has Governor DeSantis said what he thinks about this issue?
Well, he hasn't, but his lieutenant governor is on TV this weekend saying it's real reform. And so I think it's pretty clear where he stands on this. And I think that's an interesting point because we don't know what is going to come from the new MDX. And this, by the way, MDX is going to sue over this. So if this gets through it, the MDX is going to try to knock this law, declare it unconstitutional or whatever the tactic is. But if this happens, the politicians behind it, Avila, Diaz, and Jeanette Nunez, are going to own these expressways
that's
and all
correct.
The gripes that come with it. I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the new board to actually lower tolls. That would probably be the end of the Kendall Parkway.
Absolutely.
And we might see, I mean, there's a lot of work being done on MDX, especially the 836. Mm-hmm. And you might see the public say, well, wait, what happened to the improvements or the work that's been underway?
But Doug, I think part of the frustration of these commuters is they've seen a lot of work. And they've been seeing a lot of work for 2-3 years now. And I think part of the frustration is they're paying these tolls. They're driving through the same construction sites every day and going, when is this going to be completed? Or it is complete, and they're saying to themselves, I don't see any improvement in my commute.
I absolutely have seen improvement. So if you're coming east or west on the 836 in the morning and in the afternoon, the congestion is still on Lejeune. But once you clear Lejeune, it's a heck of a lot better than it used to be in the past. And so there's construction now that will be finished in the summer that will open up Lejeune. And so the new bottleneck, if you have to say, it's going to be 17th Avenue. And then there's a new project that will expand from 17th Avenue to the I-95, and then that will clear that up. But no, there has been significant improvement in the flow of traffic on the MDX expressways, especially with the new work that's being completed. And so look, people that take expressways, and I can go off and now go on my county mayor role. We look at ways to improve the traffic situation in Miami-Dade County. However, all those projects take time, and you just can't build that in one day. And yes, you have 3 years worth of construction. But when it's said and done, you have a much better flowing expressway system. Nobody can say that the new interchange at 836 and the 826 doesn't work a heck of a lot better than the old one. That took a long time, and it took years of planning, and it takes a lot of money to get that done.
Speaking of taking a lot of time and a lot of money, we have got Marcos calling from Naranja, and he says that it takes him 2 hours to get to work. Marcos, you're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you,
I'm
sir.
I'm a little concerned. My average commute is about 2 hours every morning. I live in Naranja. I work on Midtown. Not only that it takes that long, average tolls is about $5 each way a day. And I'm still doing an average of 20 to 25 miles an hour. What compels me to pay so much to go as slow as the regular streets? Not only that, I understand that everything requires a lot of planning and things take years to get built up. But we live in a metropolis. This is not a small city. This is a giant city by any standard. Why our transit system is not extended to the west side of the population? Why is this only occurred or going up and down US 1 for the trains when the vast majority of people live west
okay.
of the city?
Marcos, thank you very, very much for your comment. And you know, you can understand Mayor Jimenez. There's
sure.
a lot of frustration
mm-hmm.
here, and hopefully the new bill will... Someone will help answer all of these questions in text form and in phone form that we've been receiving over the past week. But
right.
we really do have to move on very, very quickly, very briefly before
mm-hmm.
we break.
Sure.
Mayor Jimenez, okay, the legislation has passed. What are you going to do next? What's your plan?
Well, I think that there are legal issues that have to be resolved here. There is a contract between MDX and the state of Florida that says that MDX is can operate, maintain, expand the what's called the MDX system in perpetuity. So I don't know what perpetuity means to the state of Florida. Perpetuity means a long time to me. So that has to be ironed out. There's also home rule issues that have to be ironed out, the state telling us what to do. Finally, if I can answer that individual.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Very quickly.
The MDX had a plan to implement a mass transit system on MDX roads. MDX actually took over the smart plan aspect of the east-west connection. I don't know what a successor agency is going to do.
We've been talking to Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, who is also the chairman of MDX, as well as Doug Hanks, who covers transportation issues and much, much more for the Miami Herald. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We need to take a short break. Up next, Palm Beach County parents and teachers speak out against a bill that would share public dollars with charter schools. If you have a comment or question for our panel on that issue, we would love to hear from you. So please keep our number handy, 1-800-743-WLRN. We'll be right back. I'm Christine DiMatte, and this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Last November, an overwhelming majority of Palm Beach County voters agreed to raise taxes to improve the county's public schools. The measure opened up a four-year, $800 million funding source to boost teacher salaries and expand security and mental health services on public school campuses. But many charter schools are hoping for access to those funds, and hundreds of teachers, parents, and grade schoolers took to the streets this past week to voice their disapproval of that idea. Now, if you are a parent, teacher, or student, we would love to hear from you. So please call 800-743-WLRN. Joining us now via FaceTime audio is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Madeline Fox. Hello, Maddie.
Hey.
And over the phone, we'll also hear from Andrew Mara. He's an education reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Christine.
Andrew, first, there's sometimes a bit of confusion about exactly what charter schools are, what's expected of them, who funds them. So very quickly, what is the difference between a charter and a traditional public school?
Well, a charter school is privately run by a nonprofit organization here in the state of Florida, but they receive their funding through the same, generally through the same sources as traditional public schools. That's primarily a mix of local property taxes and state revenue.
Okay, so basically, charter schools really have to have some academic guidelines to follow, just like public schools do.
That's right.
Okay, this week, Palm Beach County parents and teachers rallied against a bill that would distribute funds raised by tax increases to charter schools. Today is the last day of session. Okay, so what is the status of that bill?
It's been going back and forth. It's last I saw, it was in the Senate, and it's gone through two iterations where the language would or would not affect Palm Beach County. I think the last I saw was this would affect special property tax money in the future from future referendums, but not the one that county voters took last year. But again, that could change between now and the end of the session, so it's sort of hour to hour at this point.
Right, it's make or break time. Maddie, you were at the rally this week. What were you hearing from teachers and parents? Maddie, you with us? Maddie Fox, are you with us? Hello. Okay. All right. We lost Maddie. We'll get her back. Andrew, what have you been hearing from the public school teachers and parents in Palm Beach County? There was a rally this week. They wore black. They said, you know, we don't like the idea of sharing these this funding with charters. What are you hearing from them?
Well, that's right. Yeah, the rally earlier this week, I think, was the biggest teacher rally we've seen in the last few years. It was well organized, and they certainly did their best to make a statement. They have a particular concern here because the referendum money that was approved by voters last year is going to be going into teachers' salaries. They're all in line for large raises, with the largest raises going to the most senior teachers. And if some of this money has to then be shared with the charter schools, there's a chance that some of that money, will have to be, those raises will be reduced. So they could actually see cuts to their salaries as a result of this. So it's very personal for them, as you can imagine.
And I think we've got Maddie back. Maddie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Okay, so there's been some legal action taken by charters against the Palm Beach County School Board. Where does that stand?
So I actually defer to Andrew on this because most of what I know about it is from his reporting. But my understanding is there's at least three schools that have sued to try to get a cut of that $800 million windfall.
Okay, and Andrew, how are those lawsuits going so far?
Well, that is correct, and they're still pending. They were filed a few months ago. The two separate suits involving three schools, like she said, and I don't think it's gone. They're still going through the early motions of filing motions for this and motions for that. So it hasn't really been put to the test yet. And whatever the ruling is at the its first stop in court, it surely will be appealed. So I expect this will take a few years, and it's hard to say at this point how that's going to go. And, of course, it might be overtaken by events in the state legislature.
Okay, so we've been talking with WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Madeline Fox and Palm Beach Post reporter Andrew Mara. Thank you both.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's South Florida Roundup. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mayers. WLRN's director of radio programming and technical supervisor is Jason Zavka. I'm Christine DiMattei. Thanks for calling in and listening.